propaganda.
Industrial complex. A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert. Tonight we're going to present a special broadcast of PID Radio. As Sharon and I sat down to prepare for this week's program, we really wanted to discuss some of these details of the Virginia Tech massacre that didn't sit well with us. Things that really raised some questions for us. As it happened on Friday afternoon in my radio program here in Columbia, Missouri, I interviewed Peter Lavenda, the author of The Sinister Forces Set and Unholy Alliance. And he's written a couple of pieces that have been posted to his website, his blog at sinisterforces.info, about the killings at Virginia Tech and the rather superficial analysis of what drove Cho Seung-hui to become a stone-cold killer. So rather than rehash that same conversation between the two of us, we'll present for you now the audio from the interview conducted Friday afternoon with Peter Lavenda on KSSZ-FM, The Eagle, 93.9 in Columbia, Missouri.
This is the show they don't want you to hear. It's Off-Road Friday on The Drive from The Eagle 93.9 and TheEagle939.com.
Find the subject matter of what we discussed today interesting. You might also be inclined to tune in tomorrow night. Coast to Coast Live with Ian Punnett. We run it every Saturday night between 8 p.m. or 10 p.m. and midnight. And this week, Ian Punnett is going to host St. John Hunt. He's the eldest son of E. Howard Hunt, who was the guy who inspired the character of the cigarette-smoking man in The X-Files. And St. John Hunt's going to talk about his dad's direct knowledge of the planning, particulars, and motives in a JFK assassination. So you'll find that tomorrow night. Coast to Coast Live with Ian Punnett, 10 to midnight on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com. Our guest now, the author of a three-volume set called Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft, Peter Lavenda, joins us again on the Eagle 93.9. Peter, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Peter's website is sinisterforces.info, and he's posted a couple of I think very thought-provoking and insightful pieces over the last week or so regarding the shootings at Virginia Tech. And, Peter, in those pieces, you kind of confirmed what my sense has been of the news coverage of what took place at Virginia Tech, that the analysis of what actually drove Cho Seung-hui to kill has been pretty superficial. What was your first thought, first of all, on that day when you began to hear the news coming out of Blacksburg, Virginia?
Well, I think like a lot of us, just a tremendous shock and horror that this was taking place again. It's not that long after Columbine, after all. So to know this is happening again and to think that this might be the beginning of a pattern is the thing that probably occurred to me first. But right away, my problem was with the media coverage, quite frankly. It's kind of hard to form, a reasonable opinion on the events that are taking place if the media itself is interjecting its own point of view or its own agenda in the proceedings. So for me, it became a little confusing. I didn't feel that I was getting the straight story, as it were. I mean, we had this mysterious two-hour gap. We had two murders that had taken place initially. We had the university running along as business as usual, and then a few hours later, more killings were taking place. Obviously, everybody was confused by this, and I think that we still don't have the whole story on that. We still don't quite understand how the university reacted to this information, or what they felt that their responsibility was. I guess that's still going to be debated.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the press coverage of it, it was bizarre. It was strange. I mean, we are being told basically that we have another crazed lone gunman, it's just somebody who went off his went crazy and decided to start shooting his fellow students, and we're left with that, and that's it. I mean, there's really no more depth, no other angle, no other perspective on the story than that. And I think this story is crying out for some kind of analysis, for something a bit deeper.
You mentioned a pattern. What pattern do you see Cho fitting?
Well, initially, we could talk about Columbine. Obviously, he idolized the Columbine killers in his writings. He considered himself a kind of martyr in the same mold. So we could start with Columbine, but actually I see the pattern going back a lot further. I see a pattern, as I mentioned in my postings, it reminds me a little bit of Catcher in the Rye, a kind of satanic version of Catcher in the Rye. We have a Holden Caulfield character in Cho, without making too fine a point of it. But here we have someone who is alienated. I mean, that's the term that they were using a lot in the press, especially in Time magazine, a series of articles that I took great exception to. But they were referring to Cho as alienated, and that his alienation led him to commit this act. Well, alienation to me is a two-way street. We tend to alienate other people from us if they don't fit in, or if they if they through their appearance or through their actions or behavior they're not conforming to a social norm. At the same time, they feel alienated because they don't conform to all of these things. They're not fitting in. There's a disconnectedness that takes place. Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye was, you know, the archetype of this for young people. He was a young guy in prep school who was feeling alienated and was dismayed by the materialism he saw around him. He was dismayed by the phoniness and the insincerity. He didn't go around killing people. He didn't have a Glock 9mm at his disposal, I suppose. But in Holden Caulfield's case, he was simply, he went insane. He went slowly, he had a nervous breakdown due to what he was seeing around him and the effect it was having. And I think it's not coincidental that for some reason we find Catcher in the Rye in the hands of some of our more famous assassins. You know, Mark David Chapman being probably the most famous.
Mm-hmm.
So you have somebody who identifies with this character, with this figure, who then goes out to kill. Holden Caulfield didn't go out killing anyone, but his admirers have. And I think this is a pattern that we have to look at. We have to take this quite seriously, I think. We have to find out how this is happening. As Salinger, who wrote Catcher in the Rye, was writing as someone who had gone through World War II in the intelligence field in the war. He was denazifying Nazis for the intelligence service. So it seems as though he had a very close point of view, a very clear perspective on violence and on the nature of violence. And yet, it's the people who came after, it's the Mark David Chapmans, who picked up on this idea of alienation, of youth being alienated and packing heat, you know, in a very American response to this. Salinger's novel was almost European in its sensitivity, and then suddenly we have American youth who are reading this thing and who are thinking to themselves that, yes, you know, I want to be Holden Caulfield, and the only way to do that is to pick up the gun and shoot somebody, either shoot somebody famous, like Mark David Chapman did, or in my analysis of Cho, you know, shooting everybody in sight. So I see a pattern there, and I see a very strange pattern, and one that we've been ignoring.
Author Peter Labenda is our guest on the Eagle 93.9. We're talking about the events at Virginia Tech last week. What prompted, or what could prompt somebody like Cho to then, or Mark David Chapman for that matter, to try to emulate Caulfield or to use Holden Caulfield as an inspiration, but then take that beyond the border into a violent response?
To me, if you were to ask me my own opinion, which of course you are, I would say that the Catcher in the Rye was written before 1963. I think that the events of the 60s have changed Holden Caulfield. He's become someone else. I think that with the assassination of Kennedy and the events that took place after that, immediately after and on down to the present day, we've created a kind of a violent Holden Caulfield is what we've done. I think that when you have Mark David Chapman as an example, he was a mental patient. I mean, as Cho was. Cho only briefly, and Chapman himself only briefly. Cho was a mental patient in Hawaii at a mental clinic there, at Castle Memorial Clinic, I think it was called. And it was after that time that he started to develop these ideas, these violent ideas about Lenin. And what's interesting to me is that Cho himself, in his own plays, in his own works, refers to the Lenin assassination and refers to the Marilyn Monroe assassination as well. So we have Cho and Chapman meeting on this kind of common ground. Chapman using the Lenin committing the Lenin assassination, and Cho referring to it. I mean, there's a continuum, there's a thought process that's taking place, that the society they see around them is evil, is causing death, destruction. It's phony. It's insincere. It's materialistic. And some of our weaker members, those who are we consider weak, but who are actually the more sensitive, perhaps the more psychically sensitive to this, lose it. And they enact the only way we've taught them how to act in our society. We've glorified violence to the point where violence seems like, you know, the obvious solution to even a psychological problem or a spiritual disorder.
Author Peter Lavenda, the guy who created the three-volume set Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft, is our guest. We're discussing the events that took place in Blacksburg, Virginia last week, the Virginia Tech killings. What could lead a quiet, socially maladjusted young man like Cho Sung-hui to pick up a couple of guns and turn into a stone-cold killer? Our conversation with Peter Lavenda continues. This is Off-Road Friday on The Drive. I'm Derek Gilbert. You're listening to The Eagle 93.9 and TheEagle939.com.
Boldly going where no talk show has gone before. This is Off-Road Friday on The Drive on The Eagle 93.9 and TheEagle939.com.
We got the best of the Eagle 93.9 for you all weekend long. The best of Neil Bortz tomorrow afternoon at 2. The best of Glenn Beck tomorrow afternoon at 5. The best of Hannity Sunday at 10. Best of Bill O'Reilly and the Radio Factor Sunday afternoon at 1. And then, of course, you get the Drudge Report kind of wrapping up the weekend live Sunday night at 9 p.m. on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com. Our guest is Peter Lavenda, author of Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. We're talking about Cho Sung-hui, the Virginia Tech killer, and the forces that may have driven him to kill. What are some of the things that Cho might have been exposed to? And I know we're really speculating with a minimum of information here, Peter, that would prompt somebody who, by all accounts, was just a very quiet loner to suddenly explode in this orgy of violence.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we're all asking ourselves. My reaction has been, let's put it this way, the Time magazine had a number of articles trying to analyze Cho. In one case, they called him alienated. In another article, they called him narcissistic. I felt that these were, you know, sort of pat responses to the question. They don't really dig very deep. It's the kind of thing you would expect from, I suppose, a national news magazine, you know, that features articles on Beyonce or something. So I think that the ideal is to go just a little bit deeper than they did and to understand somebody like Cho. What did he see around him? Here's a young man who migrated to the United States with his parents. He was, I think, 9 years old when that happened. So from his native Korea. So we're talking about Asia to America, which itself is quite a quite a trip. I mean, it's quite
a culture shock, right?
A culture shock, absolutely. You know, we're talking about a very integrated kind of society, a sort of a monolithic or vertically oriented kind of society where everybody is, speak the same language, they generally share the same culture. Then to wind up in the United States, which is a conglomeration of all different kinds of cultures, where the rules aren't so easily understood, the social rules, the rules of social etiquette or interrelationship of behavior, they're not clear. So he's growing up at a tricky age, 9 years old. He's already spent a couple of years in school probably in Korea, and now he's switching to a completely different system here. And around him, he's seeing what we see every day. I mean, what has he seen in the last 10 years or so? He's seen 9/11. He's seen the invasion of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan. He's seen the same images we all see of Abu Ghraib, for instance, of all the criticisms that have been leveled against this country. And does he really feel like he's an American? Does he really feel connected in any way to our culture, to our society, to our political system? You know, what are his religious beliefs? What kind of roots did he have? What did his parents bring over with them from Korea in terms of values? You know, all of these things have to be answered. All of these questions have to be addressed. But basically, here's a person who symbolizes the term alienation, in a sense. I mean, what's more alienated than an alien, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
Without trying to be too funny about it. But, I mean, here's a person who's come here and now is trying to cope with the society that he sees. And oddly enough, he's majoring in English, right, which is a foreign language to him.
Yeah.
Or was. I mean, I'm positive from what I could see of the tapes and everything else. He's perfectly fluent. That's not the point, though. It's not the language he grew up speaking. So now he's proficient in English. He's going to dominate our own language. And at the same time, there's part of him that is disgusted with everything that he sees around him, rightly or wrongly, but simply that, he's disgusted. What's tipping him over? What's pushing him over the edge? Was it something stupid? Was it something somebody said or somebody did? You know, was it any small thing could have set it off? But obviously we're talking about a circumstance that built up over time. He purchased his weapons over a period of time. He obviously planned this thing in advance. He planned the media package that he sent to NBC. This was not a spur of the moment, you know, somebody who just cracked in one moment. He got fired from his job, you know, or, you know, postal worker going nuts. This is something that's been taking place over a long period of time. He would go to school, sign his name as a question mark. He wouldn't talk to anyone. And he kept writing these horribly violent works in which there is simply murder, violence, and all sorts of mutilation going on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he saw on television every day. This is what we all see. We all see this.
Quentin Tarantino wins awards for writing stuff like that, you know?
Exactly.
There are many, many questions, and the things that you're raising right now are questions that should be asked by the major media, and we're not seeing them, and that's what we'll continue to discuss as we continue through the next hour. We'll also open up the phone lines for questions at 874-9390, 800-529-5572 if you're outside mid-Missouri. Peter Lavenda is our guest on the Eagle 93.9. His website, sinisterforces.info, you'll find information about his books there. Unholy Alliance, which is a fascinating look at the occult underpinnings of Nazi Germany, and Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. Straight ahead, look at world and national news from ABC. We'll check in on the Eagle 93.9 24-hour news and find out what's happening here in mid-Missouri as well. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is Off-Road Friday. You're listening to The Drive on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
Off-Road Friday. This is The Drive with Derek Gilbert on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
Monday afternoon on The Drive, we're going to talk with Danny Schechter. He is the director and producer of a new film called In Debt We Trust. Seemed like a timely thing. It's kind of curious to me that we hear that the net savings rate for Americans, the average savings rate for Americans for the last few months has been a negative number, meaning that you and I are spending more money than we take in. And yet we still see television commercials advertising 125% mortgages. We'll give you 125% of your home's value. That doesn't seem to make sense to me. And Danny Schechter explains why he thinks that is. Monday afternoon, In Debt We Trust, the director of that film will be our guest on The Drive. I'm Derek Gilbert, and we are talking with Peter Lavenda this hour about the killings at Virginia Tech University. What drove Cho Seung-hui to become a stone-cold killer? And if you've got a question or a comment, we invite you to join the conversation now at 874-9390. If you're outside mid-Missouri, it's toll-free, 800-529-5572. You can email us, thedrive@zrgmail.com. Or send us an instant message at the Eagle 939 using AOL Instant Messenger. Peter, your blog post, the pieces that you posted, they're so well written. I think calling them blog posts doesn't do them justice. At sinisterforces.info, you make an interesting observation about Cho and the fact that he filed the serial numbers off the guns. It seems like an unusual thing for someone to do if they don't intend to come out alive.
Right. This is the thing that bothered me immediately the first day when I started to hear the reports. I asked myself why you would do that if your intention was to commit suicide and go out in a blaze of glory. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any rationale for that. And let's remember that he bought those guns at two different periods of time. There was a period of was it 60 days or something between the purchase of one and the purchase of the other.
Mm-hmm.
But the serial numbers were, according to the press reports, filed off of both guns. So it wasn't as though he filed his numbers off of the first gun, you know, and changed his mind. It was a consistent behavior. So why was he doing that? Was he planning on not being caught? Was he really planning on escaping? And if so, why would he think that he would? It raises a lot of questions. On the other hand, it might have been something as simple as, you know, bad guys do this on television in the movies. You know, they file the serial numbers off so they won't get caught. But the corollary to that is, won't get caught. Cho was going to get caught. And yet, this idea of identity, I think, is a real central one to understanding Cho. By removing the identity from his guns, and removing his own face, let's be blunt about it, when he shot himself in the head, he shot himself in the face with what I think were hollow points, based on the photographs that he was sending to NBC of the bullets that he had of the ammunition. So he was using essentially hollow points or dum-dums to blow his face off, which means he was erasing his identity at every step of the way. That doesn't connect with the mailing of his media package to NBC, you know.
No, it doesn't. You know, and that answers a question, though, raises another question, is why he would do that. First of all, anyone you try this experiment at home. Pretend that you're holding a gun and then try to turn the gun around and face it, and shoot yourself straight on. It makes more sense to try to do it through your temple.
Right.
It's a lot easier. Why shoot through the face? Why have the hollow points in the first place? But you're right. There's an inconsistency there. And another inconsistency, filing off the serial numbers, and yet we are told through the media reports that he had the receipt for the gun in the backpack that was found next to him.
Right.
So why would one carry the receipt for the gun if you were trying to conceal the trail? It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. We did have a news report. I don't know if you heard about this. The last day or so, some robber with an AK-47 tried to rob a store or a bank or something, and was successful in robbing it, but managed to leave behind the receipt for his weapon, and that's how they found him. And the receipt had his name and address on it. Sometimes criminals are just plain stupid, you know. But in the case of Cho, who planned this thing so meticulously and thought of everything every step of the way, including bringing the chains with him to chain the doors, you know, and having the media package ready so he could mail it out in between killings, all of this seems to be the result of very meticulous planning. So the receipt thing bothers me, and the fact that some of the eyewitnesses to the event did not report Cho wearing a backpack or carrying a backpack at all. You know, and there are differences of opinion as to the clothing he was wearing. So there's, you know, I mean, I hate to get paranoid about this, but, you know, was there more than one Cho out there? It's one of those things that you ask yourself, you know. When the two killings took place, for instance, in two different, completely different areas, and you have what appears to be a very personal homicide in the first killing. I mean, Cho went there to kill a particular woman, a female student there at the university, and wound up killing one of the advisors who lived in the same dorm. So he was, I guess, what you would call in the military collateral damage. So that seemed to be extremely personal. And yet everything was ready in Cho's mind and in Cho's life for this major assault on the classrooms. So that seems inconsistent to me.
Yeah, it is very odd. Derek O'Dell, who was one of the students, the one who was shot in the arm and survived, he was all over the cable news networks the day after the event, reported that Cho was wearing a black leather coat and maroon hat. Black leather coat and maroon hat. And then another student, Aaron Sheehan, who was interviewed repeatedly, said that he was dressed sort of strangely, almost like a Boy Scout, very short-sleeved, light tan shirt, and some sort of ammo vest.
Yeah.
No black leather coat, no maroon hat. So, yeah, there is a question there about what exactly took place. I've got some other questions about how this relates to Cho's frame of mind or state of mind, but we've got Rankin on the line calling in from Columbia here at 874-9390, and we'll bring him in on the conversation. Rankin, welcome to The Drive. You're on the air with Peter Lavenda.
Yeah, I heard this on the radio only once. I wanted to verify. It seems like did Cho, or did he not, attend part of his formative years at a Wahhabi school?
Wahhabi school? I don't think there's any evidence of that at all.
No, I've never heard that at all. I mean, of course, that would tie into my other thesis comparing Cho to suicide bombers, but I've never heard any of it.
I heard it.
Been
another
Wahhabi
check.
School.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Rankin. Appreciate that. And we'll talk about the possible meaning of Ismail Axe as we get a little further in. The apparent disconnect between the receipt for the gun and filing off of the serial numbers, Peter, does this indicate anything about just a disordered mind or sloppy thinking, or does it? How does that fit? Can we sort of synthesize this into some working theory here?
Well, I've been trying to. You know, it's just that the receipt throws the entire event into a different light. I mean, everything else was planned so well. Everything else was, you know, was obviously in months and months of planning stages, that something silly like the receipt for one of the guns doesn't make any sense. So if we have to assume that he did, you know, commit both of these things consciously, then we have to really question his entire motivation. You know, we have to ask ourselves, you know, is this, are we talking only about a completely deranged mind here? And if so, then we have to redefine our definitions of deranged minds, you know, because there are two types of serial killers, I think, as we know. There's the ordered type and the disordered type, you know, and the disordered type is the kind that's very messy, leaves behind a lot of evidence, creates chaos. The other kind of serial killer is a type that's very methodical, very painstaking, very difficult to catch, changes their modus operandi every once in a while, you know, changes their methods, their victims and everything else. So maybe with Cho we have, you know, two personalities fighting within the same, you know, within the same body or in the same soul. You know, we have one type which is very orderly and very, very conscientious about his planning. On the other hand, someone who's rather messy about it. But it seems to me too far to go to look at that receipt and say that, you know, he was just being messy or disordered. It could have been just a simple, stupid oversight, you know, that he had it crumpled in the bottom of his bag or something and forgot about it. But I don't know. You know, it's kind of hard to believe. I mean, I don't know if I hesitate just to go out and say, well, Cho was crazy. These are the acts of a crazy man. You know, it doesn't answer any questions.
No.
It doesn't save us from possible events like this in the future. So I think we have to look at all of this much more clearly. And we need access to the information that, quite frankly, the police have. They're looking at.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Peter Labenda is our guest on the Eagle 93.9, 874-9390, 800-529-5572. We go now to Fulton, where Wyatt is calling in. Wyatt, you're on the Eagle 93.9 with Peter Labenda.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Great. Hey, I've got a theory about why Cho would have erased the serial numbers on the gun.
Okay.
Your guest was talking about him erasing his identity, and I don't know how much you guys know about defaced firearms, but any time a firearm is defaced, the federal government requires that firearm to be destroyed, so that gun would never be able to be used again.
I see.
Okay. So basically, he was ensuring that gun would never be... that he'd be the last one to use it?
Yeah, I mean, it erases that gun from pretty much the world, just as he's erasing his entire identity. It erases the identity of that gun also.
Hmm.
Interesting
thought. Thank you, Wyatt.
That's interesting.
Thanks a lot.
The other bit of information that came out during the press conference held by the police in Blacksburg yesterday, which caught my attention, was this, that they have not yet established a clear tie between Cho and the first two victims.
Wow.
They've established that the gun was used, but they can't figure out why Cho chose his first victim and then the RA who tried to intervene.
Okay. Well, all right. So if they're admitting at this point publicly that they can't establish a direct link, then we have to entertain the possibility there was more than one person.
That raises a whole can of worms. Tell you what, we'll save opening the lid for that can of worms after the break here, and we'll get more calls in as well. For Peter Labenda, he's the author of the three-book set, Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft. We're talking about the events that took place at Virginia Tech, the shootings, deaths of 32, plus the killer himself. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is Off-Road Friday on The Drive. You're listening to the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com. Peter, how long have you spent researching the various, you know, strange interconnections of some of the way I've characterized your work in the past, the 6 degrees of Charles Manson?
Right. That's pretty good, actually. I should use that. Well, since Watergate, really, since about 1973, 74, when the Watergate thing started to happen, I started to notice a lot of the same names show up that had been involved in Bay of Pigs or, you know, other political incidents, you know, during Vietnam, et cetera. So I started to pay attention then, and I started to collect details then, newspaper clippings, and, you know, we didn't have an internet in those days. So
right.
Everything was hard copy. And I started collecting a lot of information at that time, and slowly it evolved into what Sinister Forces has become.
It is a highly recommended work. In fact, earlier this week I was talking with Todd Burke, a local trainer in proper use of firearms, and he made a note to... get to Amazon.com and pick up the books. It's a fascinating work and eye-popping when you start seeing some of these names and how they're interconnected. Today we're focusing on the events of last week at Virginia Tech, and we've got Dean from Hartsburg who's been holding on through the break. Dean, welcome to the Eagle 93.9. You're on the air with Peter Labenda.
Hello.
Ah, thank you. Hey, I was, your conversation brought up something I had read from Carl Jung that suggested that rebellious behavior, unresolved or untempered, might possibly lead to some type of psychosis. And could these, the filings of the gun and whatnot, could just, they just be details of that rebellion or that rebellious nature, attitude?
The filing of the serial numbers?
Is it, yeah, just part of the character that he was fitting himself into.
Right. He was trying to, in other words, to become the archetypal revolutionary or rebel. I see where you're going. Sure. Yeah, possibly. There are just so many other overtones to his act and to the material he was sending out and to the plays that he was writing in his English writing class. That seems to me to indicate it's more than rebellion. There was something else at the core of his personality. I mean, there was a strong sexual element, obviously. I mean, a lot of what he was writing about concerned pedophilia or child abuse, etc. So there was a lot of that involved, which made me immediately wonder if something like that had actually been taking place. Because if it had, that would easily be, you know, explain the source of his trauma. We know that child abuse, strong child abuse, continuous child abuse, leads to the dissociation of personality. So,
I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Now, are you speaking of his character in a temporal sense, or more of in a being influenced by some other factor?
Well, I don't know. I assume from his writing and the way that he was writing, he was writing from some kind of personal experience. Of abuse.
That was one of the plays that he submitted to that English class that helped to get him, you know, asked out of the class by his professor at Virginia Tech.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the details on that. This actually brings to mind a guest that you had here two or three weeks ago. I think it was a St. Louis-based paranormal research firm.
Mm-hmm.
And they were viewing their subjects through, I believe it was the electromagnetic spectrum, and they were seeing energies or orbs or something to that effect, and some of them attached to the people. I mean, are you maybe suggesting that they're being influenced out of some other...
By entities.
Exactly.
We're talking a spiritual influence.
Right.
Well, from my point of view, and as I mentioned on my website, I mean, to me, Cho's acts are symptomatic of a spiritual disorder, certainly. I don't know, if I would go as far as to say that it was, you know, outside influences from that point of view. I tend to look more towards, agents of an unfriendly government when I think of hostile forces, external forces, maybe our own government or something. I mean, Cho looked like, his behavior was so much like that of Sirhan Sirhan. I mean, his writings reminded me of Sirhan's drawings, you know, the man who was accused of assassinating Bobby Kennedy. In 1968, I mean, Sirhan's writings would have "kill, die" with exclamation points written through his journal, and over again, this repetitious kind of focusing on this event. And yet, externally, Sirhan was a very peaceful, very calm person. So there was a lot of discussion that perhaps Sirhan was being programmed. He was hypnotically programmed as an assassin, which is something that I tend to credit to a certain extent, knowing of the individuals who were around him in the days leading up to the assassination. So when I looked at Cho's writings, It occurred to me, I just flashed on that immediately, that there was some kind of programming taking place. Whether it was deliberate programming by an agent of government or someone like that, or whether it was just the programming that we're all being subjected to constantly, you know, by our media and by the political situation, you know, I don't know. It's a relevant question, but until we can get more information out about Cho and understand more about his background and see more of his writings and see more of his history, I think we're kind of bristling in the dark a little.
For my personal use, what is your website?
Oh, it's sinisterforces.info, I-N-F-O.
.info. Have you ever read or any of the Apocrypha?
The Apocrypha, from the Bible, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, of course.
Okay. Interesting question. Dean, thanks for your call. We need to move along, but we appreciate your call and your comments. 874-9390, 800-529-5572, the numbers if you'd like to join the conversation with Peter Lavenda. Peter, the information that we're lacking, really, is about Cho's background, about his childhood and how his parents factored into that. And since the incident, his parents have completely disappeared.
This is the thing that I thought stunning from the very first day. Normally, there's going to be 10 or 15 satellite trucks outside the parents' home, mm-hmm. Trying to find out what's going on, and there was nothing. I mean, there was nothing. So this mystified me. Did they disappear immediately as soon as the news was being broadcast? How did they get out of town so fast, if that's, in fact, what they did? There were no shots of the parents' home. There was no film footage of where they lived that I remember seeing. So what happened, I mean, they have an older daughter, obviously, who went to Princeton and was involved with, and is still involved, I guess, with the Iraqi reconstruction. That's right away a strange set of coincidences, and it makes you wonder if Cho was psychologically aware of that and could not somehow accommodate that in his own worldview. The fact that his own sister is working for Iraq reconstruction, maybe he interpreted that as working for the invasion, working for the things that were being committed out there. So
sure, and that's a question that we've asked here on this program. The rant in his writings against against rich kids, this was part of the package he delivered to NBC, seems not to fit with the fact that his older sister went to Princeton. That's not the cheap proposition.
No, not at all. I mean, that costs some serious cash.
Which raises another question, because according to the relatives who were interviewed back in Korea, the Cho family had to scrape up every penny they could get their hands on and arrive in order to make the flight to the United States, and arrived here penniless in 1992, and yet 8-10 years later they were sending Cho's older sister to Princeton.
Right.
Very strange. Peter Lavenda is our guest. He's the author of the three-volume series, Sinister Forces. We're talking about what happened at Virginia Tech last week, and our conversation will continue as Off-Road Friday on the Drive continues. Now we turn to the 24-hour newsroom on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
Like a lift kit for your brain. This is Off-Road Friday on the Drive on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
More stimulating talk with no static all night long. Michael Savage and the Savage Nation at 7 o'clock, Neil Bortz at 9, and of course then George Norrie with world-famous Coast to Coast AM. Open lines tonight at midnight on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com. We're talking about and trying to take a deeper look at the events that took place at Virginia Tech last week with author Peter Lavenda. His books, highly recommended, Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft. You'll find more information at his website, sinisterforces.info. Lines are open, if you can get through, at 874-9390 or 800-529-5572. Jeff in Columbia has kindly held through the break. Jeff, welcome. You're on the Eagle 93.9 with Peter Lavenda.
Good evening. I've got a comment that the both of you have made what I think to be two major assumptions, which I think are going to prove to be erroneous.
Okay.
One, the first one is that morning he planned to kill everyone. I think he had intentions to do it, but his timing was not of his own making. I think that's fairly clear, that the first killings provided the impetus for him to commit this narcissistic blaze of glory where he kills so many, and he took the 2 hours to take the plans he had made, the writings he had made, the tapes he had made, and he made some more, and make the pack. I don't think his intention was to kill anyone that morning. I think that he was provoked to an act of murder by sick and passion. And the second assumption I think you make is that there's anything to be learned from this at all. He's a classic psychopath. He meets all the criteria that we've seen before. There's nothing in this man that is unusual or unexpected for a mentally ill person like he is.
All right, Jeff, appreciate your comments. Thanks for calling in. Peter, your response.
Yeah, I'd like to address that a little bit. As far as him not wanting to do the killings that morning, I'm not so sure I agree with that. In the first place, we don't know as the police have themselves admitted, that he actually was the shooter for the first two murders. That's something that has to be proven yet, I guess. We could assume that he was. But I don't know if the amount of work that he had ready at his disposal, including the huge amount of ammunition, the chains for the doors and everything else, he had pre-planned this. I don't think that that this was suddenly something just tipped and made him crazy in a moment and he went nuts. It seems as though there a lot of planning went into it. I don't see that this was the act of a psychopath who just went off, you know. I think I understand what the caller was trying to say, that the first killing might have been the premeditated one, might have been the crime of passion, and that once he had been blooded and drawn first blood, in a sense, then he felt compelled to go and commit the other killings and go out in the displays of glory, mm-hmm. as the
nothing,
caller said.
Nothing left to lose at that point.
Nothing left mm-hmm. to lose. Mm-hmm. And yet, he took 2 hours. I mean, think about it. If I had just killed two people in the morning, in this building, at the university, do I really feel I have 2 hours to go back to my dorm and to get all this stuff together and to psych myself up into killing a lot more people? Wouldn't I, if I was somebody like Cho, feel that the police were going to be on to me at any moment and blow me out of the sky? You know, why did I assume that I had that much time, that I could go back to the dorm, get all my stuff together, mail a package to NBC, right, mm-hmm. and then go to the classrooms and, you know, chain the doors and start killing people? Classic psychopath, maybe. I don't know. I think that we, you know, our definitions of psychopath in the last couple of years with the DM, the Diagnostic Manual of Mental Disorders, has changed a lot in the last 10 years or so. I don't think we can use that label quite so blithely. I think there's different degrees and variations of what constitutes a psychopath. But I think if we just dismiss him as a psychopath and say end of story, I don't see ourselves as protecting ourselves, you know, from future, you know, incidents like this at all.
Your piece is inspired by the Time magazine articles, which will hit the newsstands on Monday, analyzing Cho's rampage. You indicate that there is a disservice being done by the type of glossy magazine page, superficial analysis of what happened. What purpose is served? What purpose are they trying to serve with the sort of with this sort of armchair psychologist type of analysis of what drove Cho to kill?
Well, to me, it seems that what was being done in those two articles, and specifically, there's an article by Jeffrey Kluger and one by David von Draeli, which are the ones that I address. And you'll see them when Time magazine comes out. To me, what these two authors were doing was filing the serial numbers off the guns, you know? I mean, by making this facile observation that Cho was just simply a narcissist and a deranged guy who went and killed people, what we're doing is we are trying to say that there's nothing more to see here, folks. Move right along, you know? It's just too easy, and it implies that everything's under control. Don't worry about it. Every once in a while, we get a crazy guy who goes off his nut and starts killing people. And he was a narcissist. He was, you know, simply sick. Let's not make this anything more than it is. Let's not look any deeper.
Right? He's not like us. You can sleep soundly tonight.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
We put distance between him and us so that we can feel better, perhaps, about ourselves.
Right. And that's just blowing him in the face one more time.
Peter Levenda is our guest on the Eagle 93.9, talking about the events at Virginia Tech last week. 874-9390 or 800-529-5572. The words inscribed on his left arm, Ismail Axe, in red ink. What do you make of that?
That perplexed me for a while until I began to wonder if maybe the last word, axe, really was A-C-T-S. I mean, meant to be axe. Ismail raises to me a number of questions. Is this Ismail in terms of, you know, the Ismaili sect of Shia Islam, right? Which is, people would jump to that conclusion, I think, right away. The Ismailis, of course, gave us the Assassin's Cult. So the Hashishin, the first cult of the Assassins, Hassani Saba, back 1,000 years ago, was a sect of Ismaili Islam. So, you know, he's an assassin, and he's killing people, and, you know, he's working, you know, he's an Ismaili in that sense. Not that he was an Arab, and not that he was, you know, a Wahhabi, as one of the other callers suggested. I don't credit that at all. I don't see any evidence for it so far. But he could be just taking his inspiration from that. I mean, he seemed to have been well up on his assassination lore with his references to Marilyn Monroe and John Lennon, more than, you know, a lot of 23-year-olds that I know who would not understand the references.
Right. In fact, earlier we had a caller who asked us to tell him who Mark David Chapman killed. And, of course, Chapman was the guy who assassinated John Lennon of the Beatles.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he understood this. I mean, he had the connections down. He knew who these people were. The other association that came to me right away, knowing that Cho was an English major, was Call Me Ishmael, right? The opening line of Moby Dick.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are the only references that I can see. And I think ACTS at the end was like a, you know, your SMS or your IM abbreviation for ACTS, A-C-T-S. Maybe the ACTS really meant that.
Hmm. Yeah, I went so far as to go to one of those internet sites where you can punch in words and it will return every possible anagram combination.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, didn't come up with anything that made male six, you know, didn't seem to make any sense.
Right.
It is perplexing, and we may never know what was going through Cho's mind beforehand. All we can do is look at what happened and the evidence before us and try to make some sense out of it. And, you know, frankly, I'm still coming up mostly empty here. Peter, is there anything in our culture? I know from reading your books that you've argued that the United States government or elements within it, in the mind control experiments undertaken by the CIA in the 50s and 60s up into the 70s, possibly down to the present day, we don't know for sure, but at least confirmed from the 50s through the 70s, in effect made deals with the devil to try to create targeted assassins or other people who could be used in very specific capacities. Is Cho or people like Cho, you know, Diebold and Dylan and Klebold, people like they are they sort of a collateral damage from what we've engaged in over these last 60 years?
Well, I think so, because who do we have in our culture these days as moral models of moral rectitude or spiritual models, you know, in our society? We're running low where that's concerned, because we've made so many deals with the devil since World War II. I mean, starting with bringing the Nazis over and coddling them, basically,
mm-hmm.
and protecting them and making sure they were not being apprehended by justice. Once you start doing that in the name of a so-called greater good, once the end justifies the means, I think we create a culture in our society which is very damaging, especially to young people who are growing up and seeing the cynicism that exists and the cynical manipulation of the truth that's existed in this country for a number of years now. We have created this environment. We've created a very sort of sick environment. And then when we report news like Abu Ghraib and all of this, people start to ask questions. I mean, there's a great website, there's a blog posting back in July of 2005 on a site of a guy called Professor Pan. If you find his website, it's on charm.net. Sex, Drugs, Mind Control, and Gitmo. And it refers to an article that was written in The New Yorker about the kind of brainwashing, mental conditioning things that were going on at Abu Ghraib and eventually at Guantanamo, and how sex was being used, mind control, drugs, and everything else, just an echo, a complete mirror image, basically, of what was going on with our own intelligence forces back during the Cold War, you know, with our behavior modification and our, you know, mind control brainwashing programs. You know, and I don't want to sound like a lone nut myself by talking about these things. people don't want to, you know, credit. When they hear the word brainwashing, a lot of people turn the channel, and I don't want them to do that. I want them to take a good cold, hard look at the documentation that's been declassified in the last number of years concerning that program and the amount of testimony that was given before the Rockefeller Commission. I mean, if you really read this stuff, your hair will turn white. It's just horrible things that were committed in the name of, you know, protecting our freedoms. And now, you know, we're doing this again. And not only are we doing it again, we seem to be taking some kind of perverse joy in it, which is what really bothers me as well. We don't even have the grace to be embarrassed by it anymore.
And we've got people who profess to be believers in, you know, the old Superman tagline, truth, justice, and the American way, defending such acts because it's in the interest of spreading democracy.
Well, right. I mean, if you don't agree, you're not patriotic. If you don't agree with us, you're committing treason.
Yep. Peter LaBenda is our guest. He is the author of the 3-volume series, Sinister Forces. We're talking about what happened last week at Virginia Tech and trying to make some sense out of 33 deaths that otherwise are senseless. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is Off-Road Friday on the Drive on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
Live, local, and listening to you. The Drive with Derek Gilbert on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
Monday afternoon on The Drive, we'll talk about why people seem, why credit card companies and banks and mortgage lenders seem so interested in extending more credit to us when we're probably already overextended. We'll talk with Danny Schechter, producer of the movie In Debt We Trust. That's Monday afternoon after 5 on the Eagle 93.9. Final segment with author Peter Lavenda, the guy behind the three-volume series Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. His website is sinisterforces.info. Peter, the fear, or the, I don't know if fear is the right word, but the concern I have is that we just won't take anything away from what happened at Virginia Tech. And I don't know that we've got enough information to do that yet, but as we try to bring this to some sort of conclusion here, or bring it full circle, if you will, is there anything that we can draw from what Cho did or what happened at this point?
Well, like I say, it is hard to do with the lack of information that we have at our disposal. However, we know that he was a student at the university. We know that he was he had evidenced signs of mental distress long before the killings had taken place. No one did anything about it. He had been briefly in a mental institution just for observation for a very short time. Seems to have been given medications. We don't know the whole story on that. There seems to be some discrepancies in that part of the story. But, I mean, we could be discussing any number of students at any number of our educational institutions,
right,
when we discuss Cho. So we have to really, I think this case has to be really dissected. It has to be a multidisciplinary force of people together to dissect it, to understand what it is, because I believe there will be copycats. I think that Cho, I'm sorry to say, but Cho will become some kind of a cult hero to some people. I mean, he did have this complete multimedia approach to what he did, and that alone is going to get him some kind of following. I mean, Charles Manson has a website, and he has followers, and some of his family members are still devoted, and he gets new groupies every day, you know. So I think that Cho will also generate this kind of interest. I'm positive there are going to be T-shirts with Cho's picture on it. I mean, this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He's created himself, essentially, as a kind of cult hero by what he's done. And in doing that, it's going to make it very difficult for us to look seriously at his motivations and to try to figure out what's really going on here. And I think we have to really understand, too, what the responsibility was of the police at Blacksburg, the university police. Was there any federal government involvement in the standoff, you know, before the shootings or during the shootings? We need to know these things. We need to know what really was going on. And as usual, we don't. You know,
there are some isolated reports that have come out of Blacksburg that indeed the local police and EMTs were told to wait for federal backup before they went in. And that may explain why it seemed on the videotape that the police were not responding as quickly as they might have, given that there were shots still being fired inside the building. One more piece to the puzzle.
Yeah. I mean, it bothers me. All the details bother me. I think it bothers most Americans. But what we're going to do is we're going to forget about it. We're going to say he was just crazy and go on to the next news story and forget about this. And, you know, we had Columbine, and it was the fifth anniversary, you know, of Columbine. It was also Yom HaShoah. It was the Holocaust Remembrance Day,
mm-hmm,
which is when the killings took place. You know, there was a lot of bizarre little synchronicities there that were taking place around this event. And I think it deserves...
Yeah, April is a bloody, bloody month.
Yeah, sure is.
We just passed the birthday of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a lot to consider here. One final question with just about a minute, Peter. Your own thoughts on this. Was there a spiritual component to what took place?
Well, to me, yes, there is. I mean, to me, this was Cho represents a spiritual disorder that's in our country, and we touched on it briefly. This idea that, we sold our soul to the devil at some point back around the time of the Cold War, and we bargained our moral values and our identity of what it means to be an American. We kind of traded that in for our security, as we've been doing so many times since then. And I think we've lost, we've lost who we are. And then when we have other people coming to our country to become part of this, they see that we've lost our sense of identity. So how can they be expected to embrace our values?
Peter LaBenda, author of Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. His website, sinisterforces.info. Peter, always a fascinating discussion.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us again on the Eagle 93.9. Coming up Monday, again, we'll talk about debt, why we're being offered more credit when we're already overextended. Danny Schechter, the producer and director of the new movie, In Debt We Trust, will join us on The Drive. I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle 939.com. And thank you for listening to this edition of PID Radio. The show notes for this show and all previous shows are archived at PIDradio.com, including links to Peter LaBenda's website and, of course, a link for our email address, which is radio@peeringintodarkness.com. If you'd like to send something to me directly, it's derek@peeringintodarkness.com. Sharon, of course, sharon@peeringintodarkness.com. And the forum, which is always open for your comments about the topics raised today or in any previous show, you'll find that at peeringintodarkness.com/forum. Sharon and I will be back together next weekend. And until then, I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Adamson thought she was going back to her quiet hometown of Eden, Indiana, to settle the affairs of her late Aunt Celeste. Instead, she discovers that Eden has literally gone to hell. Two high school students have disappeared, leaving behind only a running car and a bloody shoe. Strange lights have appeared over the town, and the fields of a local farm are marked with blackened circles. Eden County Hospital reports record births, incredibly large babies joining the ranks of a growing number of giants. Many of Eden's leading citizens have been hiding evil secrets, but their behavior has been closely watched by the mysterious Dr. Apollo Bell, head of the Mount Hermon Institute. All of Eden is a war camp, and citizens must choose sides in an eternal battle. Catherine is reunited with her old flame, Joshua Carpenter, the publisher of the Eden Chronicle. They quickly learn their strongest ally may be John Thundercloud, a legless old Winnebago Indian who spends his days writing line after line in a library full of tattered diaries. It's Winds of Evil by Sharon K. Gilbert, book one of the Laodicea Chronicles. Available now online and at bookstores everywhere.
They're coming from the darkness. Over 6,000 years ago, the citizens of Mesopotamia encountered them.
Down through time, tens of thousands of people on every continent of the world have etched their likeness on the walls of caves, chiseled statues of them from solid stone, and prayed prayers to their highest gods to be delivered from them.
But prophecy says they will return, and at a time when Babylon, modern Iraq, and Iran is invaded and destroyed. This spring, exclusively from RaidersNewsUpdate.com, we'll tell you what you need to know about them. In the book-length ebook, Stargates, Ancient Rituals, and Those Invited Through the Portal.